Last week on Come Receive the Light, I shared this excerpt from a conversation we're going to hear today.
And the monks claim that it's the actual burning bush in which Moses heard the voice of God. Now, they also claim that it's in the same place. But the truth is, they actually moved it about 500 years ago in order to expand the basilica. And then I notice off to one side is a fire extinguisher. And at first I think this is an eyesore, and then I realize the unintended humor. Is this in case the burning bush catches on fire?
It's definitely a fun conversation, and I'll share it with you in just a few minutes. We'll also hear from a professional counselor who dealt with her own grief in a very unusual way.
Yes, it's really true. I mean, it was never my intention to sit and to do this type of a project. I thought maybe one day I would write, you know, like more of a narrative. But this was just so perfect because, first of all, this is not a death and dying book. There are enough death and dying books, and I don't need to write another. This is a book about healing and getting through hard times.
That's Dr. Deborah Derman, and she's up first on our broadcast today. Welcome to another edition of Come Receive the Light. I'm Mike Trout, and our regular host is Father Christopher Metropoulos. He is the president of Hellenic College, Holy Cross Greek Orthodox School of Theology, and also the founder of the Orthodox Christian Network on the web at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. We're a nonprofit outreach and do appreciate your encouragement and, if possible, your financial partnership. You can give safely when you go to the website. Again, myocn.net. Well, walk into any bookstore these days and there they are, dozens of adult coloring books. Yes, I said adult coloring books. These beautiful books are fun and have also been found to offer emotional health benefits. And now veteran grief counselor Deborah Derman, Ph.D., has designed an adult coloring book entitled Colors of Loss and Healing, an adult coloring book for getting through tough times. We've invited her to join us today to talk about her book, about grief and moving on. And handling the conversation is our OCN team member, Emmy Louveris, who has just asked Dr. Derman why she wrote the book.
Well, the story's a little bit long, so bear with me. But I have had a very long personal history of some pretty traumatic losses. I had a very close friend who committed suicide. Actually, his first attempt was right outside my bedroom window. I was only 27. Fast forward to now I'm married and have a little boy. I was waiting for my parents at a local airport here in Philadelphia to come and visit, and their engine stalled, and they crashed in front of me, so all four people died. I know, it was, I just don't even have the words, but to say that it was traumatic is the best I can do. I was married at the time, and just as I was expecting my third child, my beautiful, young, wonderful husband went out to play rugby, and he died in the middle of the game of a sudden and unexpected heart attack. So now I'm widowed with a four-year-old and a two-year-old and a baby on the way. And by the way, the doctors had told me at that time that they expected that something would be wrong with my baby, but they couldn't say what. So the whole duration of that pregnancy was very stressful until, thank God, she was born and she's fine. And then, just when I thought I've paid my dues, I got breast cancer, and I had a rare form of it. It was it required years of treatment, as breast cancer does. I'm happy to say that I have survived 11 years, and that's a really good thing. I went back to school. I realized that just because my experiences were this way didn't mean everyone's would, and I got my doctorate to really study grief and loss so that I would have a more academic viewpoint. So, Emmy, I got a coloring book for my last birthday. I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but I'm old. And I had not colored since I was a little girl, and I looked at this book and said, oh my goodness, how will I ever fill this in? And I just picked up a pencil and I started with one space, Then I did two spaces. Then I did three. And I'm telling you, I had a light bulb moment. Oh, my God, this is exactly how I did it. One small step at a time. And that's when my coloring book idea was born.
And out of a true life experience comes the most wonderful ideas.
Yes, it's really true. I mean, it was never my intention to sit and to do this type of a project. I thought maybe one day I would write, you know, like more of a narrative. But this was just so perfect because I looked at, first of all, this is not a death and dying book. There are enough death and dying books, and I don't need to write another. This is a book about healing and getting through hard times. So I took the elements that I thought were important for healing, and I distilled the elements into single words, and then I embedded them in an illustration. So now, and I've also given you a page to journal, your own thoughts, not my thoughts, but your own thoughts. So now you've created a beautiful, calm space for yourself, put away your death certificates, your health reports, your bills, your condolence cards, your legal papers. Just clear a space and sit down and start to color. But I'm asking you to do more than just color. I'm asking you to focus on my word. And then from a place of peace and quiet, you can start to gather your own thoughts. I think it's very important.
Along with that, can you help explain, because people's experience, obviously, in traumatic situations, it brings out anxiety and addictions and anger and, you know, a lot of emotions, because it's individual for each person. And certainly going to a counselor is a great help. Tell us, what is the value of having a grief counselor?
Well, I'm going to speak about the way that I practice. I don't know if it's how everyone else does, but when I sit down with someone who comes to me for grief counseling, I want them to know that they can tell me anything. It's completely private. No one's going to hear what they say. Some emotions can be pretty difficult to express. Maybe someone feels, oh my God, how could I feel this way or that way? But I always start out by saying, look, these are the things that have happened to me. Not better than you, not worse than you, but I understand this personally and professionally. And I think having the right person to talk to who you trust, whose opinion you value, can really help you move forward. I think it's very important.
And certainly moving forward is what you want to do.
You do want to do it. And that doesn't mean you forget who you love.
Of course.
My daughter, the one that I told you about, who I was pregnant with when I lost my husband, she just graduated from college. She never met her dad, of course. We were lucky that we had named her. You know, when I found out that I was expecting, that we at least had a girl's name and a boy's name. But she never had the experience. I don't even have a picture of him holding her. He doesn't even know she was born.
Right.
So when she graduated from college, the feeling of, oh my goodness, I just so wish her dad could see, or that my parents could see. And, you know, is something wrong with me for missing him and wishing he could see that? I don't think so. I love him still. I wish he could see the wonderful things that his children are doing. And those feelings just come up from time to time. And I think that's perfectly normal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that kind of brings me to my next question. A lot of friends and family are at a loss for words when something like this happens. You don't know what to say. You're afraid to say the wrong thing. You're afraid to say something that might bring up an emotion that might be negative, or you just don't know. Is there a right thing to say, and what would that be?
Well, first of all, you are correct. I think the hardest thing for someone who's grieving is to feel, you feel so isolated and so different. It's always front and center in your mind, at least in the first phase of it. I think the best thing that someone can say is, I'm so terribly sorry for your loss. How can I help you? I'm here for you. What can I do? That's what you do. It's so simple. Will someone cry? Maybe they'll cry. But those are good tears. It's tears of thank you for acknowledging my loss. It's not bad. And I don't mean this to sound harsh, and maybe it will, but I'm speaking from someone who's been through it. Another person's feeling of discomfort really pales in comparison to the pain that I am feeling. So don't worry about yourself. It's a time to really 100% think about the other person, and you will never go wrong if you do that.
Yeah.
It's the worst to feel that people have forgotten, because believe me, you haven't forgotten.
Right.
You know what you remind me of something, and of course we're all thinking about Orlando and these horrible murders and all of the trauma going on. When people have experienced a really significant trauma like that, they're probably not going to remember a whole lot in time. It's just a function of the trauma.
Right.
So I found years later, I went through cards and letters that people wrote to me that I had absolutely no memory of even looking at years ago.
Mm.
So sometimes writing something down, a person can keep it, and then maybe years later they'll open it up and say, wow, this was really a kindness.
Yeah, that's amazing, right?
Yes. And I'm hoping that people will keep it as a keepsake, because, I mean, I kept a journal when my husband died, and believe me, it's really, really tough looking at it now, but it was a very healing thing, and I hope that people will hold on to this book as just a marker of what they were experiencing at the time that they wrote and colored. And what's very interesting about it is that 1 year later, 2 years later, 3 years later, they will look back on it and they will be able to measure the difference between then and now.
Amazing.
It's a little like watching paint dry. Sometimes
yeah.
you don't think you're moving ahead or forward or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
But you do. So you just don't notice because it's you.
Of course. So your book, Colors of Loss and Healing, an adult coloring book for getting through tough times, is available on OCN's Amazon web store. So look for the link on our website at myocn.net. And I'm sure that it's available. Is it available elsewhere?
Yes, it is. Actually, if you go on Amazon, you can go on Amazon Smile, or it might be called Smile Amazon. And if you will put in my most favorite charity, it's called the Baby Bureau. You can put the Baby Bureau in and they'll get a few cents toward their expenses, and I'm on their board, and we provide gently used baby clothes and handmade quilts and so on to mothers in need in our local Philadelphia area, and it's a fabulous, fabulous agency. So if you could do that, it would be really wonderful and very appreciated.
Well, thank you again for being with us today and for sharing a little bit about your life and how this wonderful book came about. We appreciate your time, and honestly, I look forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Again, the title of Dr. Deborah Derman's coloring book is Colors of Loss and Healing, an adult coloring book for getting through tough times. And as Emmy said, we will have that available in our online bookstore. When you link to Amazon through our online bookstore, any purchase you make generates a donation back to this ministry. So however you eventually attribute your purchase, you will be supporting this ministry when you access Amazon through our online bookstore. That's at myocn.net. Again, myocn.net. Well, our next guest actually has an unexpected link to the conversation we just had. Bruce Feiler is an American writer and television personality. He is the author of 12 books, including 6 consecutive New York Times nonfiction bestsellers. We're going to talk with him about a book entitled Walking the Bible that was also turned into a PBS television special. Bruce was diagnosed with cancer a number of years ago. I am very happy to say that he is in remission, But that's the unexpected link to the conversation we just had with Dr. Deborah Derman, and perhaps we can talk with Bruce sometime in the future about his experiences. He wrote a book called The Council of Dads that dealt with some of his cancer process. But today, we're talking about walking the Bible.
I'm walking, yeah, the need, I'm talking, you and me, I'm hoping.
Bruce, let's look at the first question. Having visited many of the places that you reference in your book, I'd like to know why you chose to write this book in the first place.
Well, I grew up in Savannah, Georgia, as you know, and had spent much of about 15 years traveling around the world, entering different subcultures, Japan, England, country music. And what I would do is I'd go enter a world and come back and write about it. And in the course of this, I decided that I wanted to reread the Bible because it was on the front page of every newspaper behind some story or another. It seemed to be ever-present in books and movies. And I hadn't really read it since I was a kid, which meant I hadn't really read it. So I took it off my shelf and I put it by my bed where it sat untouched for 2 years, and then I went to visit an old friend in Jerusalem, and what happened to me is what happens to many people, maybe you, when you first went. My friend said, well, over there is this controversial new neighborhood, and over there is the rock where Abraham went to sacrifice Isaac, and it just struck me, I mean, these are real places, and this kind of crazy way I live my life, I thought, well, here's an idea. What if I travel along the route and read the Bible along the way? And that's what led to the idea, which was to go to the places, in this case it ended up being Turkey, Israel, Palestinian territories, Egypt, the Sinai, and Jordan, kind of find the places insofar as we can find them, and then read the Bible along the way. What happened was I found an archaeologist, an Israeli archaeologist whose name is Avner Gorin, who had been the chief archaeologist of the Sinai for 15 years and lived in the town of St. Catherine's, near St. Catherine's Monastery. And he agreed to come. He was the first person who told me I wasn't out of my mind, really, to be honest. And we set out to do this, and we kind of focused on stories, say, Noah's Ark and Mount Ararat and Sodom and Gomorrah and the crossing of the Red Sea, stories that could be perhaps enhanced by reading them in the locations. And so that's kind of how we did it. We did it kind of for practical. We would go for a couple of weeks. We'd go back. We would take time off. It ended up taking about a year. And I did it largely for practical reasons, but it ended up having an emotional impact because it took a time for the whole experience to kind of sink over me. So I was glad I had those breaks in order to kind of take stock of what was happening to me emotionally and spiritually.
And how has this book, this project, Bruce, affected your own faith?
Well, I would say that when I started, I told everybody who asked, don't worry, this is not about me and my faith. This is not about me and my spirituality or my God. I really thought that it was going to be about me and the stories, and that I was interested in, are they real? Could you identify where they happened? Did they have any relevance to my life? And very early on, I remember the first week of this journey, I was traveling in southern Turkey on my way to Haran, which is the place in Genesis 12 where God first speaks to Abraham. And I just felt this incredible attachment to the land, like I wanted to get out of the car and kind of roll around in the mud almost. And when I went back to the text and realized that in the story of the Garden of Eden, for example, Adam, the name comes from the Hebrew word Adama, which means soil. And that phrase, right, from dust we came, from dust we shall return. It seems to say that we're made from these places and we come from these places.
I'm reminded of the story. It's actually right in the beginning of the book, Walking the Bible, and it talks about your desire to go and see the place where Noah's Ark found its final resting place, and you speak to Parachute. Can you tell us a little bit about this, or listeners that haven't yet get just a little smidgen of the book?
We start in eastern Turkey in the Kurdish war zone, where 30,000 people have died in the last 10 years in a largely overlooked war, and looking for Noah's Ark. Now, there is a mountain called Ararat, which is an abandoned volcano that is, in fact, the tallest mountain in the Middle East. It's got a permanent glacier on top. It's 1,000 feet taller than Mont Blanc, which, of course, is the tallest mountain in the Alps. I go to this little tiny town, and they know instantly that I've come to town because not a lot of foreigners come to town, as you might imagine. And I say, I'm trying to find out about Noah's Ark. And so they said, well, you got to go down this room and down the street and take a left hand, there's a lane, and then go up this room and go up a dark set of stairs, and there's a man who knows everything about Noah's Ark. And I kind of go halfway and go down this alley and go up the stair, and I totally chicken out because it seems very shadowy. And I start walking down the stairs, and this man appears, and he says, well, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm here to find out about Noah's Ark. And he said, well, you were supposed to go up the second flight of stairs. We eventually sit down. He is a very kind of cagey figure, and he will only identify himself as Parachute. And he claims that on a walk up the mountain, he fell into a hole and discovered a piece of Noah's Ark. And I told him I didn't believe him. And he said, well, we've got wood. It's 5,000 years old. I said, I didn't believe that. He said, well, we had it tested. And we kind of went back and forth. And in the end, he wouldn't show me the pictures or the Ark, which is not surprising in many ways. But what I came to feel is that while there's not going to be proof, we're not going to find a piece of wood that said Noah built me. And even if we did, we're not going to find audio tape of God ordering Noah to build it. What was most striking to me about being in that place was that the stories are still alive in that place, that the young boys and girls who grew up on this mountain talk about the luck of Noah, who has it and who doesn't. So 5,000 years after these stories were first told, they are still living, breathing in this place. And that, to me, is maybe the overarching lesson of the journeys in walking the Bible.
Tell us a little bit about running across this monastery in the middle of the desert.
As it happens, the day we were having this conversation, I was on the Fox News channel this morning and talking about walking the Bible, and the question that was asked was, what's the most awe-inspiring place that you went in your 10 years of walking the Bible? And my answer, without even hesitating, was St. Catherine's Monastery.
Why?
The Sinai Desert is this giant isosceles triangle that's wedged between Africa and Asia. It's 40,000 square miles of nothing. It's an area the size of Ireland, and yet the population is only 20,000 Bedouin. It's basically dunes at the top and kind of foothills in the middle, and in the bottom, this collection of mountains. And in the middle of these mountains, hundreds of miles from anywhere, in the middle of nowhere, is this monastery. It's St. Catherine's Monastery. It was built 1,500 years ago by visiting monks who said that one particular bush at the base of one particular mountain was the actual burning bush in which Moses heard the voice of God. And it was built by visiting hermits in the 4th century who went there to get close to this bush, and it later became this Greek Orthodox monastery, and it contains, among other things, the oldest operating church in the world, where they still have services five times a day in Byzantine Greek. And I've spent a lot of time in St. Catherine's Monastery, both walking the Bible, shooting it for the photography book, Walking the Bible, the Photographic Journey, and then nearly a week shooting it in extraordinary high definition for the PBS miniseries that we shot on Walking the Bible, and was given extraordinary access, in large part because of the generosity of the 24 monks who live there, and also because Avner, my archaeologist companion, developed a very close relationship with the monastery during the 15 years he was the chief archaeologist of the region. And it's this amazing place. It's been continually occupied. It's got a mosque, which they built to kind of curry favor with the local Bedouin that's inside the monastery. And as you know, because of the desert atmosphere and because of its kind of isolated location, it has the second best collection of religious manuscripts in the world after the Vatican. And this last time I was there, I was able to actually spend some time in the library, see some of the old Bibles in Greek and Latin and in Hebrew that are there. It is an amazing place. And one of the things I did once is actually do the math. 5 services a day, 1,500 years, that's 3 million services have been held in this church since it was first opened.
When I visited there many years ago with my oldest daughter, I remember being at one of those services, a sunrise divine liturgy. And as we walked into the church, I remember they opened the relics of the saints, primarily the Saint Catherine, of course, which is the name of the monastery. And I remember, as it was yesterday, the sweet smell of fragrance of incense almost coming out. But it wasn't the incense. It was actually the fragrance coming from the relics as they were being opened. I don't think I've ever experienced anything like that in my life.
St. Catherine, of course, was an Egyptian woman who was said to have mystically met and married Jesus and was tortured for not denouncing her Christianity, and was said to have been was strapped to carts and was said to have been taken away and carried to the mountains in the Sinai to escape this torture. That's why, as I understand it, she's the patron saint of wheel makers and things like that because of this association. And one of the, and the, by far the most interesting thing in the monastery is this bush. It's actually a wild raspberry that is, in fact,
talk about that.
Yeah, it's quite rare in the Sinai because it takes so much water. And it's this, it's about 6 feet tall. It's on a 6 foot high pedestal. It looks like a kind of giant weeping willow or a wig, maybe that a circus clown would wear, having been a circus clown once myself. And the monks claim that it's the actual burning bush in which Moses heard the voice of God. Now, they also claim that it's in the same place. But the truth is, they actually moved it about 500 years ago in order to expand the basilica. And I kind of love the idea. We've all been in meetings now. I kind of love, can you imagine having been in the meeting in which they took a vote as to whether to move the burning bush or not? But they say that the actual, that the roots are the same. So I'm staying there. I got permission to stay in this monastery, which was very generous because pilgrims are not, except for Greek Orthodox pilgrims, are not often allowed. And so I decided to go sit next to this place. It's very dark. The monks all go to bed early because they got church at 4:30 in the morning. And I'm kind of, there's these staircases, and I'm a little afraid to walk down because there's this room which actually contains the skulls of all the monks who've ever lived in St. Catherine.
Yes.
So I managed to get by that, and I go to the burning bush, and I'm sitting there, and I'm like, wow, it's dark. There's, and I'm, it's the silhouette of the bush, and I'm convinced that I'm having this, like, little moment, right? That there's a heat coming from the bush and this heat coming from me, and I'm having this kind of transcendental insight. And then I notice off to one side is a fire extinguisher. And at first I think this is an eyesore, and then I realize the unintended humor. Is this in case the burning bush catches on fire? And if it does catch on fire, what do? Do I put it out? Do I look for the face of God? I'm kind of very, discombobulated, and then I'm going, go back to the moment. And as I'm doing it, this white cat with a brown patch over its eyes jumps out of the burning bush and lands at my feet and screeches at me, and I screech back and go running back to my room and study my Byzantine Greek for the morning.
Bruce Feiler, and a conversation we actually had with him a number of years ago about his book, Walking the Bible. That book is available through our Amazon online bookstore. Just go to our website at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. And the link to the bookstore is right there on our homepage. We're also a nonprofit outreach. There is a link on the homepage for donations. Just click on that, and you'll see a number of suggested ways in which you can become a financial partner with us. The summer months are always tough, and we appreciate your involvement. If all you can do is just let us know that you're listening and make a comment or two or ask a question about this broadcast, that would be a great encouragement. Again, you can do all of that when you go to the website at myocn.net. I'm Mike Trout. Our host has been Father Christopher Metropoulos. We also appreciate the additional work of Emmy Luveris, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from her more in the future. Join us when you can. We are a weekly visit here on the Orthodox Christian Network, and appreciate any promotion you can provide by telling your friends about us. Until we meet again, remember to always have faith in what you listen to.